in? Okay. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Today is Wednesday, March 22nd, 2017. I'm opening a meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. Today we'll be continuing the public hearing on the Department of Human Services Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities with Mr. Psyche, Ms. Tennanty. Anything else you want to say, Ms. Byerly?
Madam Co-Chair, just that we left off in the slide deck on slide 18 yesterday, and that is those materials are posted under yesterday's meeting in OLIS.
Great. Come on up.
So, Chair Steiner Hayward, Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, for the record, Clyde Psyche, Department of Human Services, and we're back for day two with the Office of Developmental Disability Services with Director Lilia Tennanty, and we're going to just jump right in, so I'll turn it over to her.
All right, thank you. For the record, my name is Lilia Tennanty. I'm the Director of the Office of Developmental Disability Services in the Department of Human Services. Good morning. We left off yesterday on slide 18. We had talked about the hour realignment effort that we've initiated to look at in-home, the amount of in-home services that we've been authorizing. The fact that we started that process after extensive discussions with our stakeholder, our vision advisory group, and other stakeholders, as well as legislators that were involved in those discussions, and that we started for new individuals with this assessment with a lower number of authorized hours September 1st, and individuals who are coming into, who are already in services, we started November 1st. And this will be an annual, year-long process as every as each person's annual plan comes due. So we continue on with that effort. We estimate that it's going to result in about 6.4 million general fund savings for the biennium of 17-19. My understanding that was calculated into our CSL estimates. And from our perspective and what we've shared with our stakeholders and what they totally understand, it, this is really for us a first step in a lengthier process talking about overall sustainability and what happens with the future of the program. The discussions we've had with stakeholders around those issues are really focused at this point, knowing everything that's going on, including potential changes to the Medicaid program at the federal level, and discussions we have been having since implementation of the Community First Choice Option, or K-Plan, about what's happened with Oregon and our DD system and our budget, is what we've come from the perspective of what should the expectation for services be for children and adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Understanding that these are lifetime supports. Once a child is in our system, ultimately they remain in our system throughout adulthood until they leave Oregon or after a long and full life pass on. Our services are ultimately based on our eligibility criteria, go the lifespan of each person that comes into our system. The general consensus that we're hearing from the stakeholders, including a group of self-advocates that I met with, the Oregon Self-Advocacy Commission or Coalition, I'm not sure what their C stands for now that I say that out loud, is that all means all. We want to provide services, continue to provide services to everyone who meets eligibility criteria, but there is ultimately with everyone and understanding that if that is the way we continue to proceed, that that ultimately means less for some people currently in service and less for people who will be coming in the door in the future. So those are, that's the framework for those discussions, and obviously we'll continue to have them with legislators and with our stakeholder group as we move forward. The next item on our list of accomplishments is we did get some CMS guidance around natural supports. For those who have been involved in these discussions for some time, the Community First Choice or K-Plan included a regulatory structure that basically made it very difficult and made it possible for something that was a natural support, meaning an unpaid support provided by a family member or a friend or a neighbor, to go into the column of becoming a paid support based on the desire of either the worker expressed through the person we're supporting or the person themselves. And we had seen a lot of erosion in the DD system ultimately of things that had been natural supports turning into paid supports. which was a challenge for our budget and is also ultimately, though, from my perspective, a challenge for the people we support overall, because we don't want individuals, children, and adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities to only be surrounded by people who are paid to be in their lives. That's not our goal for them, and that's not ultimately what the goal for themselves is either. So we did finally get some guidance from CMS. It wasn't as strong as I would have liked. It basically does still say that natural supports are the choice. Using natural supports in lieu of paid supports are the choice of the individual and the planning team. But they did specifically state that the state is not obligated to pay for what has been a natural support. So that gives us a little bit of leverage in terms of the planning discussions that we have going into our planning meetings, and we are looking at how we incorporate that guidance now in our overall planning process.
Ms. Tennedy, this is a question that risks coming out the wrong way, so bear with me, not just you, but everybody who's listening. What? I shouldn't ask the question, you're probably right.
No, I said I thought I was the only one who asked those type of questions.
So we all know that we can frame information and options when we give them to people in different ways. We all do that in all sorts of interactions every single day. And so I guess one of the questions is, based on that guidance that you got from CMS, how are you talking with your partners, whether it's the CDDPs or the brokerages or whoever else, or your various team, your DHS team itself, about framing these conversations with individuals receiving the services and their families and other natural supports that they have in place? One could say, we can give you help to bathe your 7-year-old child, or we can say, how's it going bathing your 7-year-old child? You know, what kinds of things are working well for you, what aren't, right? And I guess part of the issue is, how do you frame the conversation? I absolutely agree that we want to provide the right services for people. I also absolutely agree, as I know you do, that we want to help people with disabilities become as independent and self-sufficient as possible. And as you quite rightly said, having everything done for them by people who are paid to do it doesn't lead to that goal that we all share. So hopefully that came out in the right way. You understood what I'm trying to say. I don't want to deny anybody service, but I also don't want to set them up thinking that it's the right, that the better option is to get everything done for them. Right?
Yeah. Co-chairs and co-chair Senators Steiner-Hayward, I think you framed the question just fine.
Okay.
And ultimately, what you're talking about are the discussions that we're starting now that we have this guidance around our individual support plan that we talked about yesterday, really focusing on what is it that you have in place now, how is that working, and then what can we add to that as opposed to what can we give you across the board. Mm-hmm. And we haven't gotten as far as those discussions, I would say, as I'd like at this point, but we are definitely, that's the direction we're going. And to some extent, it takes us back to where Oregon was in these discussions before the Community First Choice Option, or K plan, was implemented. Because if you recall the discussion about the Staley settlement and capped budget amounts for people supported through the brokerage system, ultimately that amount of money was known that it wasn't going to cover every single need the person had. And so those discussions started from the place of, what do you have and what is working for you now? And then what can we supplement with paid supports and what makes sense? So it's really for our system, in a lot of ways, going back to looking at things and having those discussions the way we used to. So hopefully a couple of years into this, it won't be too far of a leap, because we were at that point before we went in a different direction.
Senator Gilster.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the way that I look at it, it's not just a budgetary question, it's a quality of life issue as well. I know, again, we moved into the system right after the K plan was implemented, and I was really surprised to have our son go through the assessment, and I was stunned by the number of hours that he was eligible for. And I think when you're raising someone and you care for them, you don't think about all the things you do for them during the day. And we said, we don't need this help. But the pushback was, you can't supplant paid supports with voluntary supports, and now we've identified this person needs these things, we might have to make a protective services report if you deny the services. And I was like, but I've been showering him my whole life. I'm still going to do it. We worked it out, but it's important. And the cultural piece for the independence of individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities, it's the same as putting a five-year-old in a self-contained classroom. Right. You're not just teaching that child that there's something different and separate about them, that they need all of this higher level of support. You're teaching that family that.
Right.
And the beauty of Oregon's system has been that we start with, we assume that you are competent, we assume that you are independent, we assume that you're going to pull everything together, and there will be help in that place where it doesn't come. And that's what's most respectful to people, and that's why I'm glad this is there, because every seven-year-old needs help taking a shower sometimes, not just because they have a disability, and
right.
we can't be teaching families that that there's this extra layer of assistance that's needed.
That's
on the basis of
that's
disability.
That's exactly my point, Senator. That's exactly why I was trying to frame of, you know, our goal is to help people be as independent as possible. And when you're saying a seven-year-old needs, you have to have help bathing a seven-year-old. Well, I have two children without those kinds of disabilities, and they needed help taking a shower too. You know.
And there are, to be clear, there are children with very significant physical disabilities
yeah.
where there's help, but
right.
I'm talking about
no,
your...
No, I understand what you're saying. Yeah, so I think we're all in agreement. Good, thank you.
All right, thank you. The next, I'll just move through the rest of these accomplishments. The next thing that we've been working on now for, unfortunately, quite a while, but we are getting to a point where it's ready to move into the next phase. During, I think it was the 11-13 legislative session, there was a direction to ODDS to come up with one assessment for everyone that we support. Currently, the type of assessment that is used with an individual coming into services or currently in services is driven by the type of service setting they're going into or they're in. So for group homes, we have a SIS assessment. For people in home services, we have something called the ANA or CNA for children. For people in foster care settings, we have the SNAP. And if you think about the complexity of all that, and if I'm a person who happens to be living in one type of setting, but something happens and I need to go to another type of setting, ultimately, then we get ourselves all wound up in which assessment to use or how do we do a crosswalk between the assessments. And so I think this direction was the right direction and makes sense for overall. So we worked with stakeholders and ultimately got to a point where the tools that were available we looked at from other systems didn't quite make sense, and so we jumped into the effort to kind of create our own using nationally known questions and assessments that have been developed ultimately through CMS projects and other things. So we put that together into the Oregon Needs Assessment. We've been piloting it now for several months, because what essentially in the pilot we're asking people to do is do the assessment you're required to do by Medicaid in our system, but then please, if you don't mind, also do this other assessment that we're piloting. And fortunately, we had well over 500 people finally work with us in a good way, volunteer to participate in both processes, and so we have enough of a, we will have by the end of this month, enough of a sample of people using the new assessment that we'll be able to go back to the people working with us on it and finalize it and nail it down. And then we'll go into the next phase, which is really looking at how the assessment works with people in different types of living situations, at home, in the group home, in foster care, and those types of things. So that process continues. Other things that we've been working on that I think you heard about from Director Ashley Carson Cottingham is implementing the home and community-based settings regulations. I know she spoke to that, and implementing the U.S. Department of Labor regulations. We, as well as all the other Medicaid long-term supports and service systems in Oregon, have been working on both of these things and have moved forward considerably in implementation of those. The other thing we have on here is an accomplishment, because it took quite a lot of effort and was a work that we did with the legislative task force, was coordination on a task force specific to the Stabilization and Crisis Unit. And that group, we're scheduled to meet in coming up any month now, April through June, to talk about what the group decided or what we were left with after the last meeting toward the end of last year and what progress we've made since then based on the feedback we got from all the stakeholders and the legislators involved in that process. Other accomplishments that I like to speak to is that we have continued our focus on safety and assuring the health and well-being of the people in our service systems. Because of changes within DHS, we've been able to create our own quality improvement unit. We've got the DD licensing group. This is the group that had been part of the shared service kind of structure of Ulro. We brought them back under the DD program. We also had developed, thanks to funding from 1315, a quality assurance team that was going out and doing reviews of our case management entities, our community developmental disabilities programs, and our brokerages. They have now completed their first two-year cycle of going and reviewing everyone. Really, in a lot of ways, that was an educational experience. That was us figuring out how we were going to do it. It was working with CDPs and brokerages, giving them some technical assistance as we move forward on what our expectations were. We've just started with this year our second round of going back and doing reviews again, and already from the few places we've been, we're seeing improvement just built on the learning that occurred over the last time from the last review. So that unit will also be moving under our quality improvement unit. One of the things that I think speaks to the focus, the renewed focus at DHS and in ODDS on the issue of safety is our effectiveness and stronger partnership with the Office of Adult Abuse Prevention and Investigation. I think I said that correctly. OAPI. I'll just say OAPI. We kind of worked separate from them to some extent up until, I would say, the last year and a half. The abuse investigators for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities are located in our CDDPs and are contracted. They're in the contract that ODDS has with the CDDPs for those workers. We, however, didn't have a heavy hand in managing them at ODDS because really that experience, that expertise, that knowledge, what is embedded in OAPI at the state level. And so what we've done over the course of the last year is really engage with them in a thorough process of bringing them into the involvement in managing those workers in the CDDPs. We're including them in the language. We're working to include them in the language in our contract with the CDDPs, so there's a clear involvement of OAPI with that workforce. We have initiated efforts to look at investigations and ensure that they're done in a timely manner. Some of the QBR data that you may have seen from a DHS level tracks timeliness of investigations. Our investigations were not being done in general in a timely manner. We had some CDDPs that were great, totally on it, getting it done. Then we had others that were falling well behind expectations. And so we met with them all. We shared the data that we had. For those that were falling well below, they submitted corrective action plans, and we've been working with them to make sure that they get where they need to be in terms of timeliness of investigations. One of the things that we learned in that process was that a CDDP could request an extension for an investigation citing workload issues. And so that means I've got too much work. I'm going to be late on this. Is that okay? And prior to that, we've been saying pretty much, yeah, sure. And what we did with this, given the fact that we're contracting with them, we're funding them for a certain expectation of workload, is that we removed them being able to submit workload as a reason to extend an investigation. If there are other factors that come into play, like we can't contact the person's not available, things like that, there are reasons that we will approve an extension, but we are no longer approving extensions based on workload.
Can you just clarify one thing you just said? So they're investigating an abuse allegation, and they're saying that they can't contact the person who made the allegation or the person who is the concern is that person is a victim of abuse?
Co-Chair Senator Steiner Hayward, it depends. Every situation is unique, and it really depends on the situation, and I'd be glad to come talk to you about more information with OAPI to kind of share exactly what happens in those situations.
It'd be helpful. My only concern is that, we certainly know that when we're talking about child abuse, that one of the reasons that, or in domestic violence situations, we interview the potential victim as much as we can, separate from the purported abuser, because we don't want them to have undue influence or the victim to be afraid of their abuser. And if they're being, oh, they're not available, they're not feeling well today, thank you so much. My team spoils me. you know, then I just want to be sure that we're not letting alleged abusers keep alleged victims away from people who are trying to investigate and protect those victims.
Co-chairs and co-chairs, Senator Steinhuber, I would want to be sure that we're doing that same thing. So we'd be glad to come and
have a bigger
discussion about that with you.
Thanks.
All right. The other things that we've done in the context of safety, I think those are, you also heard from Director Ashley Carson Cottingham about the Centralized Abuse and Management Project. ODDS-DD is definitely a part of that, and we look forward to having a system that allows us to more effectively track and look at allegations of abuse and investigations when they're completed. The challenges that we face in the next biennium, I've talked a little bit about, it is one of them for any Medicaid program in the country right now, we're not unique in this, is the not knowing exactly what's going to happen at the federal level around Medicaid programs, the proposed funding structure change, the specific indication in the bill that at least I don't know where it's at right now. Obviously, several iterations have occurred since then, but there was the removal of the additional 6% funding amount for the Community First Choice option. And since Oregon very aggressively moved into the Community First Choice option, that is going to have a significant impact on our programs in terms of funding, as well as whatever may happen with the either block grants or per capita by population funding. So we are moving forward every day, doing the work that we do, making the improvements that we can make, understanding that we may have to move pretty quickly at some point in the not-too-distant future based on whatever happens at the federal level. Other things that we are working with and challenged by on a daily basis are strengthening our infrastructure to improve health, safety, and well-being. We have talked a lot, and I know probably many of you, I've talked to many of you, and you've heard from other stakeholders and others involved in the DD system. We are really faced with a challenge around supporting direct support professional workforce. These are workers that are paid by our private provider agencies. We're seeing a great deal of turnover in that workforce, and for a person who's receiving services, having someone who is new come in a lot causes challenges for them, for people with significant behavioral issues, or people who just need a lot of structure. It's part of their intellectual developmental disability. They need structure. Having staff changing on them on a consistent, continuous basis puts them in a very difficult position and causes bad outcomes that we would want to avoid. So we worked with the administration, and there is a pop in the governor's recommended budget that would increase funding for these providers ultimately to increase funding for their workforce. We've collected data on the average. We started participating in a staffing survey done by the National Core Indicator Project, which is a national organization partnership that looks at outcomes for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities and people in aging systems. They also have a staffing survey. We participated in that, and we've seen that on average our wages in Oregon for this workforce are fairly low, and the data that was the providers submitted for that, they go in, they enter their data, was for 2015. At that point, the average starting wage was about $10.57, and the average wage overall was about $11.57. So if you can imagine workers trying to make a living on that, it's very difficult. And I myself have gone out and talked with several direct support professionals at different agencies, and to hear their stories is challenging. You have a ton of respect. You have to walk away from those discussions having just an immense amount of respect for this workforce, that doing everything they do, struggling with the things that they struggle, that we all struggle with, but them more so than others sometimes, based on their commitment to the people they serve. We also are looking at, with that same pop, a small portion of the money that's there, $200,000 to $300,000, would go into helping our provider agencies access training to create, to allow them to follow a credentialing program. We've had a lot of work looking at those. And, for example, I mentioned yesterday that we're using one we've now implemented one at the Stabilization and Crisis Unit. We're hoping that can be, we can do that there. get it going, and then off, and then talk with our provider community about involving them and getting them engaged too. We do have some providers who on their own have jumped into it and are doing a really nice job of training cohorts of workers to work up a credentialing process. I talked already about the quality improvement consolidation. Our unit that we're creating will continue to do that in 17-19. I hope that becomes not so much a challenge but a success ultimately as we move forward with that. We have significant capacity issues around especially children and adults with significant needs. By that I'm going to say children and adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities and co-occurring other diagnoses like mental health issues or personality disorders. On my way in this morning, I tried to connect with someone in ODDS because we've got a child with significant issues that we're trying to figure find a placement for, working with all the other systems involved. And we're no different than the other systems that you've heard about that have capacity issues, and we're all just really looking at how we can use our systems to support these group of kids and adults more effectively, both with the DD services that they need to help them, but also then the other types of services, whether it be mental health or other things embedded in that. And that's something we're looking at every day and really trying to work through.
Great. Senator Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Kennedy, what do you believe the role should be of the Oregon Health Authority in addressing these kinds of needs? As we've talked about them, it seems the needs are primarily driven by medical personality disorder and mental health needs. How equipped is the developmental disability system to handle that, and why is this the responsibility of developmental disabilities?
Co-chairs and Senator Gelser, we are working with the Oregon Health Authority. They're one of the partners, one of the players involved in this discussion. I will tell you from what we've seen in our system right now, and I say that this hurts me when I say what I'm about to say, but we have right now 41 kids waiting for residential placement in the DD system, 41. Of those, some of them come to us through our regular CDDP process through that door. Some of them come to us through child welfare. And what we see with the kids that are most difficult to place in those situations is that while definitely they have some type of intellectual or developmental disability disorder, a couple that I've been directly involved with, it's been fetal alcohol syndrome. That's been one that we see a lot. Then we have other personality disorders for adults. We have borderline personality disorder that we see combined with some mild to moderate intellectual disability. They come through our door because of that particular diagnosis that puts them into our service system. However, for a number of these people, we can provide the developmental disability supports. That's not the question. The issue is the other supports that are needed to address the challenging things that are happening with the individual that are causing them to be in crisis, that are causing them not to have a placement, that are causing providers to say, we've had this person, they've hurt too many of our staff, they've done, you know, they've run away, we can't take them anymore, here, state, you take them back. That's the piece that we are all working on shoring up, is how do we get the DD service piece in place, absolutely, but then how do we do it with providers and with other partners that can bring in the supports that a person might need around a mental health issue? We have had, in talking to, just to speak to some positive movement in this, in talking to OHA around people that live at the Stabilization and Crisis Unit, we've made a lot of progress in getting CCOs to the table to participate at a level that is necessary to support the people that we have at the Stabilization and Crisis Unit. And we're grateful for that. We're also looking at models. We've had providers who see this, they see the same need. They're coming to us saying, how can we make this work? We've had providers come to us and offer suggestions, and we're working through what that might look like. Can we do a DD license, but then also fund some mental health supports in the home? Can we do a mental health license and then fund the DD supports in the home? So these are all the discussions we're having to address this very challenging issue of folks who definitely have an intellectual and developmental disability. There is no question of that. Ultimately, though, co-occurring with that is something that's just upping the game in terms of the level of support they need.
And I think just as a quick follow-up to that, when we had the Stabilization and Crisis Unit task force, one of the things that was really concerning was how difficult it was for these individuals because they had come in through the DD door. It almost seemed like every other system says, through the DD door, that's a DD problem. And so CCOs were turning these individuals away, even for things like strep throat, for physical health, for mental health, saying we aren't qualified to care for these people, telling them to go to the emergency rooms, being kicked out of emergency rooms, people having to be driven from Salem to Pendleton to get a prescriber because of CCOs and others saying we don't take care of those kinds of people, which frankly should be illegal and is a problem. But it also puts a lot of pressure on your system. It puts a lot of pressure on hospital systems. I see Doug Barber in the room. We've got an issue with people with developmental disabilities whose crisis is a mental health crisis that are boarding in hospital rooms for not just a couple of days, not just a couple of weeks, but months at a time. And it's a problem because the doors are slammed shut in the faces of these people saying, we don't take care of people like you. And that's a problem, and I think the health authority needs to be holding CCOs accountable to not say we aren't taking people like you.
Yeah. So Chair Steiner here, Chair Rayfield, and Senator Gelser. So I probably had discussions with several of you that this isn't just an issue for us on the ODDS side; it's also an issue in child welfare, and one we struggle with on a continual basis. So. You know, we have made progress, and I really want to kind of express my appreciation because recently Director Saxton herself has personally involved herself in this issue and has actually reached out to CCOs that we were struggling with, and it's made a huge difference. But that's really just a short-term solution, and we really need to look at the system as a whole, and we really need some systemic changes. The other point I would just make is that dealing with the CCOs, it's a lot like dealing with a lot of other people in our system. There are CCOs who have stepped up and are doing an amazing job, and there are some that we struggle with, quite frankly. And so really the goal is to get us all to kind of a place where we're all working together. But I just wanted to let you know that with Director Saxton's involvement, we've made progress over the last 4 or 5 months and have come away where we were 4 or 5 months ago.
And I do know she's provided her personal telephone number, but the issue of people turning away people with disabilities and saying we won't care for you, it happens in physical health too, is it's obscene.
We should probably have another conversation. I was not aware it was this bad, and it kind of surprises me considering some of the patients we routinely care for in my practice. So, Representative Buehler.
Yeah, thank you. This brings up a couple questions, if you don't mind.
Please.
And Dr. Saiki and I talked about this a couple weeks ago, just the capacity to care for not only these kids, but the foster kids in the system is causing great difficulties, and I just think we need to start investigating new models. We just don't have the capacity.
And it's adults, too.
Adults, too. So we need to think deeply about this, because the old model, the old paradigm, is just not working, and we keep on trying to force all these people in need into this old box, and the box is just not big enough to fulfill the need. But I guess my question is, where are the 41 children you referenced right now? Do you have you give us an idea of where they are?
Co-chairs, Representative Buehler, I have the numbers for where those children are right now. Many of them are still in their family home. Others of them are with providers, living in with providers or foster care settings where they've said, this is really a lot more than we can handle. And then, of course, we do have children in hospitals, sometimes longer than we would like, looking for other placement. And then we do have some now coming to us through juvenile justice systems as well. So it's a wide variety, and I can get you a specific breakdown.
I would like to see that.
Okay, definitely.
Representative Alonso Leon?
So I'm still processing what I just heard. And Senator Gelser, thank you for bringing light. I had no idea that we had CCOs who are turning folks away, our community members, our kids, our brothers and sisters. That's not okay. I want to better understand from the CCO's perspective, are they saying we don't have the training, we don't have capacity, we don't have the experts? Why?
Co-chairs and Representative Alonso Leon, my response to that would be that that's a question that should be worked out with OHA and the CCOs. That's not something that we have purview over, and I think that to Director Psyche's point, there are some, I think the other question would be those that are doing a really good job, what are they doing? And then kind of go at it from there. So I would defer that question to the Oregon Health Authority.
Follow up.
Sure.
And I respect that. But I think, I mean, for me to better understand and support the CCO system, you know, I want to better understand and know what kinds of expertise they bring into their CCO infrastructure. That's why I asked that question. Mm-hmm. And I know you couldn't answer those specific questions, but I bring it up because... you know, similar to Representative Buter, we need to look at, certainly, is our system working and why isn't it working? And what is working? Let's duplicate it.
Yeah.
And let's strengthen it. And let's put funding into it. And then to hear the separation of those people, that language just doesn't sit well with me. Mm-hmm.
So, Co-Chair Steiner here, Co-Chair Rayfield, and Representative Alonso Leon. So it is a struggle, and what we can do is we'll reach out to our counterparts at the Health Authority and get a better answer to you. But I think it's really a good point to go back to what Representative Buehler said and some of the conversations he and I have said. It's really about, you know, we have to start thinking about service delivery in a different way and start looking at different options and not... just keep doing the same thing over and over again and expect we're going to improve or solve the issues that are facing us. We really need to work together in a different way, and we need to kind of be maybe a little bit more open-minded and a little more innovative and progressive if we're actually going to move the dial and make the improvement that we all want.
One last follow-up.
Sure.
And I think one of the, and you guys probably are doing this, and I'm probably stating the obvious, but looking at it from the client's perspective,
right? Absolutely.
Asking them what's missing, how are they not being treated, or what? I want to hear their narrative and their experience.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And that's going to bring so much more information into the big conversation, because it's really about our clients, our community members.
I couldn't agree with you more, and I also think it's important, and Director Tennessee knows this, to get the perspective of the families themselves.
Precisely. Thank you.
Thank you. And I think it's important when talking to the Health Authority. I think it's not an issue just of the Health Authority and not an issue just of the CCOs. It's a cultural issue for this population of people where there still is a great deal of discrimination
separation.
And dehumanization. I know even in our family, we had an issue. We were at OHSU with my son with a medical problem that he had, and the doctor, the specialist, said that he preferred not to treat it, and that seemed dangerous. And I asked, well, what would you do if it was my daughter who was sitting in the room? And I'm going to use a word that I don't like, but he said, well, I would treat her because she's not retarded. And so we fired him. We moved to Emanuel Hospital instead of OHSU. But that is the type of experience that people with intellectual and developmental disabilities face when they try to go to school, when they try to go to the doctor. Representative Hayden is shaking his head. He knows what I'm talking about. When they try to go to church, these things play out in ways that that impact people in every sector of their lives. And the developmental disability service system itself can't resolve all of those things when there are very significant barriers that start with looking at people with intellectual and developmental disabilities as less than human, less than equal,
agreed,
less than important members of our communities.
Okay. I'm trying not to let my hair catch on fire right now. So let's just keep going, if we could, please, before something bad happens.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate being able to participate in this discussion. The last major challenge that I'll reference is just one that we've already talked about, where we're looking at our system overall and sustainability, and what are the expectations for the people that we support going forward. The next slide is really very simple, but I find that sometimes I find myself repeating this a lot, and so I don't mind sharing it again, even though it looks very simple. Basically, our budget drivers come down to our big budget drivers come down to three very basic things: the number of people we support, the services that they use, and the rates that we pay for those services. And obviously, when you're looking at budget drivers in a system like this, maneuvering or manipulating any one of those factors has consequences. Number of people served, looking at how we do eligibility, ultimately means that some people, if we narrow the door, some people who are served today won't be served tomorrow, and potentially end up in systems less appropriate to care for them based on what their current need is. Services used, we've started with looking at our assessment and moving forward with our in-home hour realignment, where we reduce the number of hours that we're authorizing. That's a first step, as I mentioned before. This is something that, you know, we do expect, we do want people to access services. It's just the balance of what is the appropriate amount at the time that the person needs it, and how do we ensure that that's happening. Obviously, for people that we support in our 24-hour settings, we have an expectation for those providers that they get 24 hours of support, and they're there 24 hours, and so saying you get less of 24-hour support is also a challenge. Then provider rates, the other driver, really comes down to things like the provider rates, issues that we've talked about, the challenge with the DSP workforce. Looking at that is problematic for a lot of reasons. And then we also have huge workforces that are paid through collective bargaining agreements, and they do a great work out in the community, doing directly employed by employers or the people, family members or the individuals themselves. So I put this in here just to show again, these are our big budget drivers, and ultimately this is why there aren't easy answers for everything we're looking at, because no matter which of these levers or how you manipulate all of them together, or one or two, there ultimately are downstream consequences for the people that we support. The next slide talks about proposed investments in the governor's recommended budget. The governor chose to, and I know that this is something that we see as a positive and a good thing. Continued funding for our caseload growth and our cost per case. So CSL continues at the level we projected to be at in 17-19. We also have the POP that I've referenced several times to help our provider agencies stabilize and support the direct care workforce. And then the small portion of that I talked about that will also work with them, assuming it gets funded, to allow them to access modules and training systems to do credentialing programs to incentivize and build a workforce, a direct care or direct support career ladder that ultimately is one that we have to create for ourselves in this type of system, because it isn't like a nursing system that has things like CNAs and LPNs and RNs, and there's just something for people to go to. We need to work on creating our own direct support workforce for the workers that support the people that we have in these settings.
Chair,
please.
I have a quick question, and I might have missed this in your prior discussion on increasing workforce or asking for a POP on workforce. Did you say that you want to increase capacity or increase pay rates?
Co-chairs, Representative Alonso Leon, ultimately, I want to do both. We need to do both. We need to support the workers that are already in the workforce. We need to give them additional funding, wages, so they can stay in the workforce, so we're not replacing them all at significant rates. And then based on the other discussions we've had about capacity and the challenges we have with capacity in so many ways, we also need to strengthen the workforce overall so that our provider agencies are more confident expanding their services and supporting the folks we have in our system. So ideally, both. I would I would leave it to others to say whether or not the amount in the POP would do that overall, but that would ultimately be our goal in the system.
Thank you.
The next slides are our standard budget pie chart slides. As you can see from this one, the IDD program, our total funds are about $2.71 billion, or 24% of the entire DHS budget. The next slide shows how our $2.71 billion is spent in the Office of Developmental Disabilities. We have that. I want to point this out because I think it's important, that other design, 1.4%, that represents the staff we have, state staff that are managing this program. It comes out to about 141 and a half staff, if I do my math correctly. About 31 and a half of those are the caseworkers we've talked about earlier, service coordinators we've talked about earlier, working with kids in our residential program and our in-home intensive program. The rest are the state policy, our QA unit that I've discussed, DD licensing that I've discussed, and the policy folks in the office down the street who work really hard every day to manage the big part of this pie chart.
Senator Gelser. In terms of numbers, I'm looking at the CIIS at $6.8 million and the SACU at $130 million. How many individuals are served in the SACU and how many individuals are served in CIIS?
So Stabilization and Crisis Unit serves, it depends day to day who's coming in, who's going out. Under 100, usually around 90 people, 10 of those being kids. I can get specific numbers on where we're at today. The CIIS program, I could flip into my binder and find the number, but instead I'm going to say I'll get it back to you because I don't want to take time to do that. But we serve about roughly in our children's and home intensive service programs, all three of them. There are three types of services that we offer overall, if I recall correctly, roughly 350 kids. But I'll get you the specific numbers later, if
so
you don't
follow
mind.
It.
Please.
What's the description for the discrepancy in cost? So CIIS are pretty significantly needy kids, a lot of kind of vent-dependent or very medically complex. So if you've got 300 for $6.8 million, what accounts for the less than 100 at $130 million among the adults? Just in terms of the comparison of cost of services.
Co-chairs, Senator Gelser, I can also get you the cost per case. In the slides that I showed yesterday, CIIS, if I recall correctly, is included with the children's in-home, so I can get that for you broken out. And the next slide, unless anybody else has any questions about this slide, the next slide breaks it out by service area so you can see overall. So the big blue Pac-Man part of this of slide 24 is broken out then in slide 25. So you can see where in the service realm each type of service we provide, what the piece of the quote-unquote pie is. You'll see SACU broken out there. And then in this one, you'll see CIIS broken out specifically. These are the services for the kids in that very intensive program. Then we have adult group homes, adult supported living, adult foster care, and adult in-home supports make up the 1, 2, 3, 4 pieces of the pie, blue, red, or orange, depending on your screen, green and purple. And then the children's residential and children's in-home and CIS. Oh, excuse me, I'm sorry. It's combined here as well. I apologize. It's combined here as well. And I'll get those for you broken out.
And it would be helpful to have the numbers of individuals served. I think the question that, and I know it's come up in a lot of other forums, in terms of the discrepancy in cost per case in some of the different settings, does that mean that we are overfunding in one setting or severely underfunding in another setting? It would be helpful to just have that head-to-head comparison of the number of people that are served cost per case in different settings and maybe better understanding the differences in needs that those people have.
Okay. So we have the cost per case here. We can break out in children, co-chair Senator Gelser, so we can break out kids in home and then your help me understand the second. Please help me understand the second part of the question.
I think what I'm trying to understand, and it's a conversation that's happened a lot. So I'll just be really, really direct. There are some people that argue that SACU is expensive because people have a very high need. Okay. There are some people, and that is the appropriate allocation for that, and that the corollary to that is we also have people with very high needs in community programs, and that maybe we are underfunding those. There are others that argue that we are spending too much in the more restrictive system, and I don't know how to get my head around that. So it would be helpful to know what is the difference in the service, why is the cost per case higher, and if we could kind of go through that chart and know where are the people? How many people with developmental disabilities are served for that? I don't see well, but whatever that number is under the adult group homes or the other programs or children's in-home or SACU or adult in-home, just so we've got the spending, but the number of people, like who are the people that are there?
Okay. Co-chair Senator Gelser, we'd be glad to get that. We actually have it in another document, and it's here, but it's broken out in many different places, okay. So I'd be glad to put that all together for All right, so that is our pie. The next slide talks about our federal funding. As you can tell from looking at this, our federal funding is pretty significant. For 17-19, we estimate it's going to be 66% of the total amount of funding we fund, that we provide, ultimately then meaning that changes to the Medicaid program at the federal level are going to have, ultimately going to have an impact on us one way or the other, and we're just going to have to sort that out as it becomes known to us. The next slide talks about direct payments and services. This is a good slide from my perspective because it represents how much money from the Medicaid programs and services and supports for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities are ultimately invested right back into the communities where these people live. We do direct payments to providers. That's direct personal support workers that are hired by the individuals. That's provider agencies that hire significant workforces. That's a number of different things. So I think that this slide represents where we spend our money and shows that ultimately, while we are supporting people with intellectual and developmental disabilities because they're a part of their local communities, the money that we fund to support them also goes to people in those communities working with them. The next slide talks about our KPMs. This is our KPM number 12. It talks about the percentage of eligible adults who receive support services within 90 days of request. This KPM ties back still to the Staley lawsuit settlement agreement. It's really focused on people who go into brokerage systems. I would note that the big drop from about 80% down to 56% between 2013 and 14 was really associated with all of the changes that our system endured as a result of the K plan. That continued through 15, and then you see now we're kind of getting our legs under our feet. That's it, our feet under our legs, and we're back on an upward trajectory, hopefully, to shorten the length of time before people get enrolled in services once they come in our door. The next slide shows the percentage of people that we support, both children and adults, who live independently. And in this case, that's also defined as people who live with family. The majority of adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities do continue to live with family, so that's represented in this number as well as the children we support who live with family. The next slide talks about our unsupported employment goal. You saw this number earlier when we were talking about the Lane lawsuit settlement. This is the number of people who receive supported employment services, and we're pleased to see continued increases in this number, and there are only 2 years here, but hopefully as we go forward, it will continue to increase over time as we make more progress in employing people in integrated settings.
I was kind of waiting until we got to this to ask this question, although we talked about supported employment and things mm-hmm. like that yesterday a little bit. I have heard, as I suspect many of us have, from constituents or family members of constituents who work in some of the what we've historically called shelter workshops, who were very upset about the decision. Lots of them who loved it, but some of them who were very upset and said that their son or daughter had tried worked in supported employment in a general public employment setting and had hated it and felt less independent and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. How's it going supporting? I mean, I've worked with them very hard, and as you know, and I'm wondering how it's going statewide with supporting families who hold this strong perspective that supported employment is not what's in their son or daughter's, or the individual themselves believes that supported employment is not in their best interest or what they most enjoy or want.
Okay. Co-chairs and co-chair Senator Steiner Hayward. This is one of the challenges and one of the things that we've been working a lot on is how do we how do we work with the people who are currently in shelter workshops and their families to encourage trying a number of different options that we now have available that probably, actually I know, were not available when they might have first gone into the sheltered workshop setting. We have a number of services like Discovery that we want people to use to learn about themselves. Maybe a job in the community has never been a goal or an expectation, or they've never even thought about it because it's not been something that's presented to them as a viable option. This is a process that really gets into that and finds out what the person is really interested in and helps them understand more about what's possible, not only for them, but also for potentially reluctant family members. We work a lot, again, with our partners, our CDDPs and brokerages, and look to them to help us in having those discussions with the families, because ultimately the families that's who they know, that's who the face of the system is to them, is that service coordinator or personal agent. It's not me or anybody at the state. The other thing that we do now today that really is a big focus that you saw earlier is we're working to focus on the transition age population, because if we can set an expectation for them, then we won't get ourselves into a situation in the future where we're trying to offer something new or different to them. So we're doing a number of things. We have a family, I call it for shorthand, family friendly report that I'd be glad to share with you that kind of lays out all the benefits. We also have success stories. I shared a couple with you yesterday, but we have many from around the state. We really try to go statewide in finding the stories of individuals. A lot of times it just requires a lot of conversation, a lot of patience, a lot of explaining what's different or what's new now. In my mind, sometimes I liken this to discussions around institutional closures. You know, families who, when an institution was closing, were adamant, no way, there's no way my family member can live successfully in the community. Ultimately, what I pride myself on in the states where I've been, where I've closed institutions, is that going back to the families who we worked all the way through the process, and they end up being the most vocal supporters of community services. And so that's the goal from my perspective, my personal goal from this effort, is that we get those families, those ones who we work really hard with, we support their family member effectively, we get them the job that they want, and they come back and say, wow, you know, this isn't what I thought we would be good, but it's turned out to be great. So that's our goal, and that everything we have right now is pointed in that direction, not just the Staley lawsuit, no, I'm sorry, not just the Lane lawsuit settlement agreement, but also the new, not new anymore, but the federal home and community-based settings regulations that we have gotten indications from the new administration that they will continue to support and move forward on.
Thank you very much.
Awesome.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Musterman, see you at the end of the table.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Continuing along that same line of questioning, if somebody has been in a sheltered workshop or they want to be in a sheltered workshop, but the community doesn't provide that, what's the plan from there?
Co-chairs and Representative Malmstrom, people who are currently in a sheltered workshop setting, we are really working with them to tell them, to talk to them and show them what is possible and what's available. Ultimately, though, while we've closed the front door to the shelter workshops, meaning no new people can come in, the people who are there can continue to be there, assuming until the shelter workshop provider or other transforms or decides they're going to go in a different direction or whatever may happen. But we aren't going in and making people leave the shelter workshop at this point if the provider is remaining open and they're supporting the person in that setting. We are, though, continuing to have discussions with that individual and their family on a regular basis about other services that are available. I talked about discovery. We also have day services that are available, just day programs. Those aren't in paid settings, but for a lot of people that I know I've talked to and families of people in shelter workshops, the benefit that they see a lot of times may not so much be the work, but it's the social engagement they get from going and hanging out with people they like and their friends. And so we have other services that would allow support that to be able to continue. And then we have the services like through VR job development and through the DD system supporting the person once they're in the job on into the future, ultimately hoping that they establish, and our goal being that they establish those relationships and that social network in the new workplace that they've gone to. This KPM is tied to our abuse numbers. It's the percentage of people with developmental disabilities that experience abuse. It's trending downward, and this is will continue to be our partnership and work with OWAPI and our DD licensing unit to make sure that we're doing everything within our control to keep people safe in whatever home situation, group home, living with family, wherever they may be or wherever they may live. And then for wrap up, as I mentioned earlier, we are paying attention to everything we can about what's happening at the federal level, like everyone else, waiting to see what potentially will happen with the Medicaid program, knowing that because of our heavy reliance on federal funding and the Medicaid match, we will need to adjust our programs during whatever time frame is made available, hopefully a long one. We don't need another short, quick jump into something without a lot of time to do it. And then we also will continue to work towards sustainability. With whatever happens at the federal level, our work towards sustainability will also continue to align with that. What can we do to ensure that the people that we support have services not only when they come in the system today as a child, but also when they've been in the system 10, 15, 20 years down the road. We want to be sure that we are supporting people throughout their lifetime, since that is ultimately the expectation that we have for our service system. We also want to continue and support the direct support workforce, not only the direct support providers that work with our provider agencies, but also the workforce that we have of directly hired personal support workers and foster care providers and everyone who's a part of our system to support people. Next up is the Director of Vocational Rehabilitation, Trina Lee. She'll be here on March 27th to continue the DHS budget presentation.
Excellent. Wow. Okay, it's 9:32. Any more questions for Ms. Kennedy? Or Ms. Psyche, maybe one more question. Ms. Brickman, were you planning on saying anything today specifically?
I don't know. That's good.
Ms. Byerly, what else were you thinking about?
I just keep thinking about this big agency and all its programs.
Okie dokie.
Tomorrow, you'll hear from the Commission for the Blind.
Oh, which will be the last of our small agencies,
yes.
Folks. So, good. All right. Well, then, see you tomorrow. Same bat time, same bat channel. We are adjourned.
Thank you.